This is an MUT Radio podcast.
Hello, I'm Dr. Amalia Gonyas-Malka. Welcome to Womanity, Woman in Unity, the show that celebrates women's milestone achievements in their struggle for liberation, self-emancipation, human rights, democracy, and much more. Joining us today is Dr. Nonhlanhla Vilakazi from Paleontology in the Zoology Department of the Faculty of Science at the University of Johannesburg. Welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me.
Dr. Vilakazi, part of Womanity's objective is about showcasing women in diverse fields. And I have to say, you are our first paleoherpetologist to feature on the show. Please tell us briefly, what is this field all about?
Okay, so paleoherpetology is the study of ancient amphibians and reptiles through the fossil record. So it involves uncovering, analyzing, and interpreting fossils. So from your early tetrapods to your ancient amphibians and dinosaurs, your marine reptiles and extinct snakes and lizards. So we need to understand their evolution, their diversity, behavior, and responses to past environmental changes. So this is basically paleontology, anatomy, and ecology all pieced together to make us understand where we're coming from or where these animals come from. So in many ways, it's like detective work. We use bones, footprints, and sometimes even soft tissue impressions to tell the stories of life long before humans walked the earth.
I have so many questions. First of all, what got you into the field and thinking about reptiles, amphibians in particular?
So I think it was during my master's. I was about to finish my master's and I was thinking of doing a PhD of paleontology, obviously. And I wanted something different. And it was Prof. Lieberger. I think most people know him as Garabo or Naledi Story in paleontology. He was my PhD supervisor. He came up with the idea that, you know what, there's no one who's looking at fossil snakes. And I think they're very important. They play a critical role. And I went back and did my research and found out that actually they play a role. And knowing my African history, that most Africans don't like snakes. They are scared of snakes. They are misunderstood. And I thought, okay, let me do this one because it will also help my community to understand the importance of snakes or amphibians.
And in thinking about the fossil elements, I've always been curious about the fact that, you know, in urban life and even rural life, that we kind of like build on top of what was there before. Where do you do digs? What kind of areas do you go to uncover the old world?
So for me, for instance, I go to the cradle of humankind. I know that the cradle is known for your hominids, but we do have other fossils like your snakes, your bovids and stuff. That's where we go. We have a site there called Bald's Farm, and I'm one of the permit holders there. So I go there at least twice a year. So we have two seasons. It's between April and June, and then sometimes between October and November, but now it gets too hot and dry now. So we usually go to the labs in the museum. So that's what we do. We go there, but I also work with I have collaborators in Namibia and also Uganda. So they do their field work there in NAPAC. They do their field excursions, and then we study those fossils.
And you were talking about when you're looking historically, and perhaps I'm reading between the lines here, is that you're able to look at climate change. You're able to look at how these creatures lived in the past and thinking about how that relates to our present. Is that right?
Yes. So that's what we do. I'm sure for especially young kids, they know about the dinosaurs, that they were here and then something happened to them. So there was a mass extinction. And my job now in my understanding is to see whether we are in the middle of another mass extinction with all these climate changes that we are seeing today. So by looking at what happened then, back then, and see if there have been any changes or transitions with these animals, we are able to tell whether we are on the right path or we are going for another extinction.
And?
Unfortunately, I think we are in the middle of one.
Really? But I know that we've got, I mean, time epochs are it's not like tomorrow.
No. It's not like tomorrow. It's not like tomorrow, but you can see that the melting of the ice caps. So clearly you have water levels rising. So you're going to have some of the land that's going to be underneath water. And we have seen this happening back then before. So it's just history sort of repeating itself now.
And is this attributed to man or just the kind of natural evolution of the earth?
It's us, unfortunately. It's us, because we whatever we touch, it we destroy, unfortunately.
How
We
sad.
destroy, yeah, we destroy, and I think it's not intentional in most cases because we are trying to better our lives. So in the process, we destroy the environment, and now it affects everyone and everything, and that's what we're seeing today.
But it is fascinating, I think, of how everything is interconnected, that there is always a cause and effect.
Yes, it is everything we touch, it is connected to something else. So I used to teach a course called environmental physiology. So we look at how the environment shapes us or shapes the other organisms, how we respond to the changes. So you can tell that even if it's something so small, it affects us. We have to respond to that change. And sometimes the response is not as quick as we would like to see. It happens in maybe three, four generations later. So it happens. Yeah.
You've got a number of different lenses in the way that you look at the world and the work that you do. Early in the conversation, you spoke about our culture and how we as Africans are often a bit intimidated or wary of snakes.
Yes.
So, in your human snake relationships across different cultures, can you tell us a little bit more about what you're doing in this field, and also possibly in this kind of like this ecosystem connection of how we can coexist in a more favorable way.
So I love telling learners, high school learners, of a story, especially if they're from Soweto, because I grew up in Soweto, and back then we used to have frogs or toads everywhere. When it rained, you would see frogs or toads, but we don't see that anymore. So I always ask them, why do you think we don't see them? It's the change in the ecosystem. It shows that we are doing something wrong with our river systems. So we need to fix that so that we are able to live with these creatures or with these organisms. Because if you see an abundance, then it tells you that the ecosystem is healthy. So in terms of snakes, you do have other nations or clans, like in the Xhosa, a nation where they believe that snakes are part of their ancestry. So if a child is born in that particular surname, a snake is supposed to come and visit and just coil next to the baby. Then they know that the baby belongs to that family. So they have that relationship with the snake. And you also find people, especially the spiritually gifted, whereby they are expected to dream of snakes. But these snakes are not supposed to attack them. They're supposed to embrace them. Then it shows that the ancestors were there. So it's always been there culturally. It's just that we as humans, we are so scared of snakes. We think that they are out to attack us. So my job and my work is to advocate for them. So I always advocate for them, and I tell people that please don't kill snakes because they tell us about the environment. They're very, very important. They tell us about the environment. If there's a shift, a slight shift, you would tell by looking at them and how they behave. So we've always had that relationship with them. We just need to strengthen it. Yeah.
Hey, and what are some of the interventions that you're putting through? Is it anything like a storytelling, or how do you put this across?
So it's usually through storytelling, and I love to teach them on how to identify the snakes because we have snakes everywhere. So you'll find that friends, they will send me a photo that, you know, a friend saw this snake. What do you think this is? Because now they have that interest. They know that I'm an advocate. I love snakes. So they know that, okay, we're not supposed to kill it. Let's just ask her because she knows more about snakes. And then I'll tell them, oh no, this one is venomous. No, this one is not venomous, but please call a snake catcher or someone so that they remove them. So that's my job. And also I have snake tattoos. So that's even worse. I have snake tattoos, and people always ask me, why snakes? Those who don't know me, then I tell them the story that this is just to advocate for them, to show that they are just misunderstood.
Fascinating, fascinating. Research is an essential and also, I think, really exciting part about academia. Can you tell us about one or two pivotal projects that stand out for you?
I think it was in 2019 or 2018 where we found a fossil snake fang. So if you've seen the teeth of snakes, it's very, very tiny, small. And we found that it's a fossil fang and we described it. It was the first one actually in Africa to be described because people look at bigger stuff. They look at your bovids, they look at your cats, but this is quite small. And we were able to describe it to species level. So we think it's a himakatus, wrinkles. So wrinkles is not a true cobra, but it mimics a cobra in a way. It has a hood and it loves to play dead. It's highly venomous, but it loves to play dead. Whenever it sees that, okay, there's danger here, it plays dead so that you move away from it. So we were able to describe that. And it's from the cradle of humankind. It also tells us about the environment that back then, about 2 million years ago, the area had, it was savanna type, it had rocky outcrops, it had grasslands, just like what we are seeing in most of Africa today.
Amazing how you can look at a tooth and then contextualize around that tooth what the creature was, where what its habitat was.
Yes, so that's what we do. I always say, you know, paleontology is like having all these puzzles and you're trying to fit them together. So you have this puzzle box with a million pieces. You're trying to fit them together to see what they can tell you about the story of Earth.
And the timelines are very different too. It's not like
Yes.
you're looking at everything in one layer. It's multi-dimensional.
Yes. So within our box farm, we have more than 30 sites, and they vary in ages. You have one that dates back to 4.5 million, and the youngest is 900,000 years old. So within one area. So you can tell that it's different. It's different timelines, and they tell a different story.
So, I was reading about some of the work that you do, and I came across one which sounded very exciting about supervising a master's student who's developing AI tools for fossil analysis. How is AI expanding the possibilities of paleontological research, and especially using an African lens?
You know, with AI, I think a lot of people are too scared of AI. They think it's here to take our jobs. And with disciplines like paleontology, it's quite old school, whereby you have to describe your stuff by yourself. But now there's some biasness, always. There's some biasness. So with AI, what we are trying to see is to make sure that we try to eliminate that level of biasness. Obviously, it's machine learning. There's going to be something happening there. But we are trying to make it easier also for schools or for researchers when they're out in the field to have that preliminary description. So whenever you're out there, you have your app, you find something, and then you try and see if it won't describe it for you, just a general description. So this is what we're doing. We've seen it happening in areas in your Western countries, not Africa. And I think it will be very, very interesting to see if it works here because we have different, the geology is different here. So even with the fossilization, it's quite different. And if we can have something that works just for us for now, I think it will be easier and better.
And then another area that you're involved in is establishing international partnerships. And I think And I think part of our conversation, one of the themes has definitely been about interconnectedness, is that these types of collaborations, it's not just about the individual, but it's also the institution that you're associated with that connects people together, and everyone becomes a contributor to their specific discipline. Can you tell us about the PHC Protea project?
So with the PHC Protea project, we collaborate with our French team. So they are from the Sorbonne University in Paris and also the Natural History in Paris. What we're doing there, it's more than just a collaboration. So it's a partnership. It's not like you're back in the days whereby people would come to Africa and then you are just there as a token. So we work together, we make decisions together. They travel to Africa, we travel to them also, whereby we just sit and we work around articles and stuff. And what I love about this collaboration is that also it uses our local context. So when they come to Africa, they know that in South Africa, it's different. We use what we have here and how we understand fossils and fossilization. They understand that it's different from what happens in Europe, how fossilization happens in Europe, and the animals or the organisms that we find here are quite different from what they have there because of the climate also. So that's how we work. We work, it's a collaboration, it's a partnership, and I love that.
And you've already built up a thriving network in our continent. You spoke about relationships with Namibia and Uganda. What are some of the biggest breakthroughs or learnings that have emerged from your Pan-African research partnerships?
So let me speak about Uganda because I'm so excited. We found some fossils there, some snake fossils. We are in the process of publishing those, and they date back to very late, the Miocene. So the Miocene dates back to about 20 million years ago. And what's different, what we are seeing here, we do have snake fossils here. We do have your snake vertebrae here, but ours are small. And when you look at Uganda, they're quite big and robust. And it tells you about the environment back then, what was happening back then. Everything was big. Does that mean that there was enough oxygen? What was happening? So we are in the process of publishing this, and we know that it's a new species. So we are working with the local people so that we name it and we use local language for something that they can relate and link with. So that's what we're doing. It's so interesting. And when you look at Namibia, their fossils are quite small. So their snake vertebrae are smaller than ours here in South Africa. What does it say about the environment? What does it say about the oxygen back then? So that's what we're doing here.
And obviously, I am not a paleontologist, so I may be asking questions that are maybe smartless. But when you are looking at the ancient world, do you ever do comparisons to the current world to see how things have changed? And as you were talking earlier, like the fact that we are probably heading towards an extinction period.
Yes. So that's what we usually do. We compare, we have something from the past, we look at what we have today in the present and try and predict what we will be seeing in the future. So we always do that because I think it's quite important for us to understand where we come from. So these fossils are telling us about where we come from and in order for us to know which direction to take in the future. So that's what we do. We always get these fossils. We try and see if they have living relatives today. And if not, then what happened? Why did they go extinct? Was it the environment? If it's the environment, what are those ripple effects from something else, like with your dinosaurs? We know that it was a meteorite that hit, but most of them were not killed by the meteorite. It was the ripple effect, so the after effect of that meteorite. So that's what we are doing here.
As a scientist and educator, you design a range of different types of programs that blend rigorous research methods along with Indigenous worldviews. Why is this integration so important for transforming STEM education, especially for young women and underrepresented learners?
So the integration of rigorous scientific methods with indigenous worldviews is essential. for transforming STEM education because it creates a more inclusive, relevant, and empowering learning environment, especially for young women and underrepresented learners. So by validating diverse ways of knowing, this approach bridges the gap between academic science and lived experience. So allowing students to see themselves as legitimate contributors to knowledge rather than passive recipients of external expertise. So for learners whose cultural identities have historically been marginalized in STEM, this integration fosters a sense of belonging, strengthens scientific identity, and elevates community-based wisdom as a sense of innovation. It also reframes STEM as a tool for addressing local challenges, from ecological conservation to sustainable livelihoods, making education not only more engaging, but also more socially meaningful. So, yeah.
You really contextualize things and make it relevant to, even though you're looking at the past, to the
Yes.
present and where we're heading.
Yeah.
Although STEM is, I'm a passionate advocate of STEM, but we really see underrepresentation of women in many STEM fields. What were some of the barriers that you personally faced and how did you overcome them?
So, you know, as a woman in STEM and in paleontology, it was a bit tricky for us. I think whenever people think of paleontology, they think of Indiana Jones, you know. So it's a rugged old white man who goes out on these adventures. We don't get to see women doing that. And every time when you come in as a woman, your capabilities are always questioned. Like, will she be able to do it? And because I'm short and a bit chubby also, and field work it can be extensive because we dig. And people, they wonder what they always are almost always shocked when they see me digging and also going out and sieving all the soils and looking for stuff. And also, as a woman in paleo, whenever we do our field work, we don't have bathrooms. So that's another thing. So we don't have bathrooms. I'm so used to it though, because it's out in the wild, it's out in the open. So you just identify a tree.
That's
okay.
mine.
That's going to be my bathroom. Please don't use this. So that's what we do. Those are some of the challenges. And I think I'm quite lucky to work with the group that I have because essentially in almost all of our field work, I'm the only woman in most cases that works there. If we have other women, it's my student and other contributors or collaborators who come once. Women collaborators, they come once a year and maybe just for a few days. So I'm quite lucky to work with this group because they understand and they treat me equally. That's one thing I love about them. They treat me equally. They don't treat me as a damsel in distress. They know that this one is capable. She can do it. And I think it's quite important for us to change the face of the discipline, to show people that anyone can do it. I've taught students who didn't know about paleontology. They didn't know what that is. But as soon as we spoke about it, that's when they showed interest. Some of my students that are my postgrad students, I taught them in undergrad. They didn't know what that was. And today, some of them are doing their PhDs because they thought, oh, okay, so if you can do it, then I can do it too. And they're loving it. So it's quite important. It's very, very important to have that representation that people can identify and link with what they are seeing before them.
And the exposure to this new world of opportunities. And as you've just said now, you know, you've taken people at undergrad and then you've moved up onto the postgrad level. And that ties into another area of our show, which is where we really think that the value of education is critical to anyone and such a transformative effect. How do you think that we can better support young girls, especially in under-resourced communities, to embrace careers in science?
I think we must first demystify and localize the concept of science by showing how it lives in our everyday actions. So walking, cooking, watching TV, making fire, or boiling water. That's science. And I don't think people understand that. They think that science is something so complex. You have to be in a lab to understand that you're doing science. But we're doing it every day. And if we allow students to see that and recognize that they are everyday innovators, whenever they touch something, that's science. So they innovate something. And I think also beyond awareness, we need structured interventions such as community-based science hubs, your mobile labs, your mentorship by local women in STEM, and accessible role models who reflect their backgrounds. I think it's very important, their backgrounds. If someone thinks that, for instance, I'm from Soweto, and they see that, oh, actually, someone from Soweto is a paleontologist, then clearly I can do it. I don't have to be in a Model C school from somewhere. I'm here from the dusty streets of Soweto. So it's quite important for us to show them that they are innovators. They do it every day. They're just not aware.
And going to a more practical level, because it's one thing where we're pursuing academics and we're enriching our minds and other people's minds, but
Yes.
are there jobs, are there career opportunities in paleontology?
Yes, I always tell students not to limit themselves because we love to box ourselves in. Like, if I do paleontology, then I have to be in academia. You don't have to be in academia. So you can be in a museum or your heritage roles. You can be a field and consultant. So you can do that. You can also be in science communication and media. People do that. You can be in your applied research in industry, whereby you have people that work in government or work in these petroleum companies, and they are the advisors. Because remember, also in construction, before any development can happen, they need specialists to go and survey the area. So you can do that. You don't have to be in academia all the time. You can be in tech and digital and innovation. So you can do different things. But just don't limit yourself or box yourself in and say, oh my gosh, now I have paleo. I have to do research. You don't have to do that. Research is not for everyone.
Such important words of not limiting yourself and being able to contribute or participate from so many different facets. We spoke about the importance of representation and how you have certainly been an inspiration to students around you. Tell us about some of the women in your journey who have been your role models.
I think for me, visibility is very important. So I'll just name one woman here in South Africa who has played a very important role and interesting, who has a very interesting journey. And that is Prof. Mamgethi Phakeng, who was once the UCT Vice Chancellor. She's not only a leading mathematician, but she's also a bold public advocate for African women in STEM. And that's very, very important. And she showed most of us that excellence and leadership could look like me, speak like me, and uplift others like me. So that's very, very important for me to show that someone who speaks like you can be in a leadership position. So she played a very, very important role in shaping who I am today. Yeah.
It's so interesting how sometimes we'll never meet a person, and yet they can have such a profound impact on the possibilities of life.
True. So it's quite interesting because I always she's we know that she's very active on social media. She makes varsity or fashionable. She's one of those people who's very vocal. And I think it's very, very important for young girls to see that someone like them can also make it in life.
Staying with a little bit of the identity theme, one of the challenges that women the world over have is about the ability to find balance of being able to manage their career demands as well as personal life. What types of support systems or shifts within the academic and research ecosystem do you think would make it easier for women to thrive without compromising on their well-being?
I think institutions must adopt family-friendly policies. Back then it was okay. We knew that most scientists, especially women, they don't get married, they don't have kids, and it was sort of acceptable or accepted. But now people they are welcome to make different changes and different they can adopt to their lifestyle. So I think it's very important to have those family-friendly policies whereby you are allowed to bring your child and you make sure that whenever you go out to the field, it is child-friendly, whereby you can bring your kids and also have extended leave. Whenever you have that, you have kids, make sure that you have extended leave. And I think that will work. It's very important to have family-friendly policies whereby it encompasses everything that is family, and we don't expect women to compromise their lifestyle and their livelihoods and their health for science, which is not fair.
And the other challenge is that often from a childbearing age point of view, that tends to happen when you're in mid-stride of your career. And I'm just also curious of how one plays the long game of being able to manage and incorporate and still move forwards.
So, with my students, because I have women students in most cases, most of them are women students. It's not about just doing your postgraduate studies only. We make sure that we have our check-ins. We talk about life because life happens. It happens, and it waits for no man. If you feel that you want to get married, it happens. You have to get married. You don't have to just sacrifice yourself in the name of science because you want to be professor one day. That will happen. If it has to happen, it will happen. But don't sacrifice yourself all in the name of science because you're going to grow old and bitter. So it's very important to understand that we need to balance. Have that okay, life happens and I also work. Take it as your 9 to 5 job. If you can do that, then it's fine.
Now, one of the questions that I ask all my guests on the show is about some of the factors for their success. So, some people will talk about discipline, focus, faith, even a particular person in their life. In your opinion, what would you say have been some of the most prominent drivers to your success?
One of the most important lessons I've learned is that failure is not an endpoint, but an essential part of the process. So it is a teacher in its own right. This has been especially true in research, where experiments falter, hypotheses shift, and fieldwork meets unexpected hurdles. So embracing failure with humility and resilience has taught me to value listening deeply to data, colleagues, communities, and also to the land itself. So it's quite important to understand that whenever you fail, it doesn't mean that it's the end of the world. It's a teacher. It teaches you something. And the I think the trick here is to just get up, dust yourself, and try again.
Was it saying fall 7 times, rise 8, or is it?
Yes, exactly. Because I know that with most learners or kids, whenever they fail, they think, oh my gosh, there's something wrong with me. I'm not cut out for this. If they can listen to our stories, most of us, we were not bright students at varsity, but we persevered. It was perseverance and that discipline that this is what I want and I'm going to get it no matter what. So it's very important to understand that failure is not, it doesn't mean that there's something wrong with you. It teaches you something else.
And it doesn't mean it's the end. You can try again.
No, you can try again, again and again and again and again.
And tell us about a few pivotal moments in your life growing up.
I think I was quite lucky that with my family, I was brought up by my grandparents and my mother, and they never pushed me or put me under pressure to go look for work. They understood that, oh, shame, this one is a nerd. She loves school. And they allowed me to be who I am, even though they didn't understand, they couldn't understand at first what paleontology is. they would always ask me, so what is this? And I had to explain over and over again, but they allowed me to thrive. They never said, oh no, you've been at school for so long, you need to go look for a job. And I learned that from a very young age, that if I get allowed to be who I am, then I thrive, because I don't have to look back and on my back or at my back, that's okay, I have time is running out for me. So those are some of the things that I learned at a very young age. They allowed me to be who I am. They allowed me to explore stuff, because I've always been that child who loves to keep to read and look for unique stuff. So yeah.
Very important of finding yourself through yourself.
Yes.
And lastly, as we come to the end of the show, could you share a few words of inspiration or motivation you'd like to pass on to girls and young women in the continent who are listening to us?
I just want to say to every girl and young woman listening across Africa, remember that science is not a distant world. It is in the soil beneath your feet, the stars above you, and the fire your grandmother tends. You already carry the curiosity, resilience, and wisdom needed to shape the future. Do not let anyone tell you that your dreams are too bold or your questions are too brave. You belong in labs, lecture halls, field sites, and boardrooms, not as guests, but as leaders and innovators. Your perspective, it is not just welcome, it is essential. You are the storytellers of our past and the architects of our tomorrow. Walk forward with courage, lift others as you rise, and never forget the world needs the science only you can bring.
That is beautiful. Such poetic words. Thank you for sharing that statement with us.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
It's been an absolute pleasure to have you on the show to hear about the world of paleontology and things that you do for our world, looking at the preservation of the future through the lens of history.
Thank you very much for having me. This was fun. Thank you.
You have been listening to Womanity, Woman in Unity, and we have been talking to Dr. Nonhlanhla Vilakazi from the Department of Zoology, where she focuses on paleontology in the Faculty of Science at the University of Johannesburg.
This is an MUT Radio podcast.